Welcome to this episode of God Needles George, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I am one of your hosts, Kyle, joined by the preacher in the house of Lopez. Tim, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Happy to finally talk some George Lopez.
I know, we keep putting it off, but we will get to it. Very excited. This is my first time. I feel I'm recording on my new, like, large desk workspace area. I got a new desk, which would be great if I had not have already filled it up with comics and action figures. They've defeated the purpose very quickly. Now I'm looking to knock things over. That's the least of my concerns, because I hate to do it to you. I did it to you again, Tim.
We're not going to have time to talk about George Lopez?
No, we're not going to be able to talk about the episode of George Lopez where the family dog, Mr. Needles, is sick with a tumor and the family might have to put him to sleep. But George promises God he would crawl on his knees up the cobblestone path to the Church of the Virgin of Guadalupe in Mexico if Mr. Needles gets better. When he does get better, George tries to pack his way out of the deal with God, but ends up in Mexico anyway. We actually have a really good episode. I'm really excited on multiple reasons. Joined by creator, editor, Robin Chapman, to talk about one of the coolest projects and one of the coolest publishers out there, American Cult and Silver Sprocket. Robin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Yes, very excited. I remember the Kickstarter and the recent kind of solicitation for the larger publication going through Silver Sprocket with American Cults. For anyone maybe that missed the Kickstarter, is not familiar with it, I remember you, like, even in the kind of Kickstarter phase, talking about kind of this being one of the most ambitious projects you had taken on. I would imagine doing any anthology is difficult. This is like a large non-fiction, really, project where the kind of a lot of empathy and thought went into it. How did this project come about? Why did you want to undertake something so daunting, it seems?
I'm not really sure how I first came up with the idea. I am interested in the stories of religious cults, like listening to podcasts and reading books and watching documentaries. The stories just fascinate me. I'm a true crime fan, and like I feel like cult stories and true crime, they feel a little similar, like they're kind of similar genres, and sometimes they're even overlapping, because cult stories sometimes do involve some sort of crime. I just found these stories intriguing, and I do like nonfiction graphic novels and comics. So American Cult is an independent project that I just did on my own time for fun. But for my day job, I am an editor at First Second, and I work on a lot of nonfiction there. So I'm just a big fan of nonfiction graphic novels, comics journalism, that sort of thing. So this just kind of lined up a lot of my interests. And, you know, when I do independent publishing, self-publishing, small publishing through my micropress, Paper Rocket Mini Comics, I usually do mini comics. I do small pamphlet books, like things that I can make with a photocopier and a saddle stitch stapler. But American Cold, of course, is a graphic novel. It's a book with a spine. It's 208 pages. So, you know, it required, you know, professional printing that's in distribution and a whole bunch of varsity level skills that I usually don't have when it comes to mini comics. With mini comics, I'm just, you know, I make them at home in my apartment, fold and staple, print about, you know, 500 copies. But yeah, American Cult, we printed 3,000 copies. It's a different ball game. Yeah.
You were, I mean, up until kind of the Kickstarter, you were like footing the bill on like paying the creators, correct? Like you were kind of paying that while like the idea of getting the funding. And again, kind of interesting with that Kickstarter as well, was like the majority of it was like kind of, you know, making sure those people got paid. Even like kind of the stretch goals was like getting extra money in the pockets of the creators, which I'm always interested in. Like I'd rather that than versus Austin like getting a sticker pack or something.
Thanks. Yeah. So we started out with a base pay of $50 per page to the creators, and then we did raise that, I think, to 70 once we hit the stretch goal, if I remember correctly. And so you multiply that by 208. That's a lot of money. So the bulk of the money that was raised and that I spent on this book was for the authors, for paying the authors. So that's one reason that this project was a lot more ambitious than a mini comic, because a mini comic, you know, you might spend a couple hundred bucks on it, but with a book that's a, you know, 200 pages and it's offset printed, you're gonna have to spend several thousand dollars. It's just a different kind of project for sure.
Was the kind of decision, like co-publishing it further with Avi and Silver Sprocket, was that at that point, was that kind of, I don't want to say easier, but like having done all kind of that heavy and front loading with the Kickstarter, was that just kind of then being able to kind of get it out to the people who missed it or in a kind of a larger public in general?
Oh, definitely. That was my big desire with partnering with a publisher like Silver Sprocket, is because Silver Sprocket has bookstore distribution, and I don't, as an individual, I don't have a Diamond account, I don't have a distributor, I don't have a warehouse. Silver Sprocket has access to all of that, and that was the most valuable thing to me as an individual, because, yeah, as a self-publisher, like, getting into bookstores across the nation is really difficult. So that is something that I want. I want to get this work out as far as I can, and get these creators seen as much as possible. So I was really hoping to partner with someone of Silver Sprocket's size and with a distribution deal. And so I'm really feel very, really lucky that Avi said yes. And I also just love Silver Sprocket's catalog and their approach to publishing. And Avi is just such a great, kind, friendly person to work with, and a real cheerleader for comics. Avi's been such a great help with this. Avi also really helped with all the printing details, because I don't have a lot of experience printing books, like working with an offset book printer to publish a graphic novel and to print thousands of copies of it. I've maybe done that a couple of times in my life, but I'm much more used to making mini comics with a photocopy machine. I've got that down, but Avi does this all the time, and so they were really the go-between me and the printer that was in Canada. And the printer did an excellent job. I got the books in a truck about a week ago. They showed up and they look great. They're really printed perfectly.
Yeah, they do. I've been so impressed kind of with Silver Sprocket. Like, they, obviously the content and the books and creators they've kind of associated themselves with is great. But being able to even, like, get those books, like, being able to order Marie and the Worrywart at Barnes & Noble, even though I already have it, but just kind of being able to do that was cool. And then to know, like, now they're on Hoopla, which is fantastic. Like, the kind of approach Silver Sprocket has taken to be able to get books and really amazing independent creators out there is pretty great to see, where, like, even at times finding, like, stuff from the big two or even Image at times is, like, difficult, but, like, to have it on Hoopla and, again, be able to just go into, like, a Barnes & Noble and say, like, I want this book and they can order for you is really great. Like, I ordered Magical Beatdown at Barnes & Noble. Like, that was fucking awesome.
So I wanted to talk about just, like, the cast of creators you've got, because, I mean, I think, like, Box Brown is a big name. I mean, I love Ben Passmore's work and Jim Rugg. How did you kind of distribute stories to creators?
Well, I reached out to, like, I had kind of this wish list of creators that I wanted in the book, and I really did look for creators that had a background in doing nonfiction comics and comics journalism. I do think it takes a, you know, certain skill set and approach to your writing and your art to really pull it off well. So of course I thought of Brian Box Brown. I actually work with him a lot at First Second. He has, you know, a long backlist of nonfiction graphic novels. And Ben Passmore, I love the work he did on The Nib. Actually, for a lot of the creators in this book, I pulled them from The Nib. The sort of comic journalism that The Nib is doing is kind of perfect for American Cult. And that was The Nib was a great way for me to discover talent that I wasn't familiar with. Like, the book starts with the cartoonist Steve Tier, I think I had discovered him at the NIB. But I hadn't seen his work before American Cult, and yeah, he was a new discovery. So in some cases it was like I discovered someone I wasn't familiar with. But in other cases I was like looking at my like wish list of some of my favorite cartoonists who do comics journalism. And I didn't assign stories. I had a few that I did want covered and I would suggest, but mostly people came to me and they said, I want to do this story. And usually I'd say, go ahead, do that one. Yeah, there might be other, might be some reason why I say, well, why don't you do a different one instead? But for the most part, I just let them do whatever story they wanted. A lot of people came with a group in mind that they wanted to cover.
How did you, you did the Heaven's Gate chapter. Did you have a history with Heaven's Gate, or why did you decide on that one for yourself?
It's just one of the groups that I think is most interesting. It's weird to say something's your favorite cult, so I won't say it's my favorite cult, but it is the group that I find most interesting, and it's, I guess because it's still kind of hard for me to make a call about how should I feel about Heaven's Gate? Should I feel that, you know, the people that ended their lives with Heaven's Gate were making a choice and that they, you know, lived the life they wanted to live and that, you know, we should just accept that? Or should I believe, as some of the parents do, that this isn't a true suicide, it's a murder? And there's also, and the other thing about Heaven's Gate that's so interesting is that there's a lot of footage that exists today. Like, if you want, you can go on YouTube and you can watch the exit videos, which are the videos these members made before they took their lives. And they're explaining why they are making this choice. And they seem, you know, very peaceful and happy. But it's, you know, it's also a very, you know, sad story in a lot of ways, and a complicated story too. Like it's, and I guess also in a certain way, like, you know, the Heaven's Gates members, that to some degree, they were kind of nerds. So I could relate to them. They were like, you know, sort of weird outcasts that were really into sci-fi. And there's something about the group that's just really, they also seem very kind. There are a couple of, you know, great documentaries and books. I would definitely check out the Heaven's Gate podcast that was created by the host of Snap Judgment, Glenn Washington. It's one of my favorite like cult podcasts. It's a great audio documentary. There's a lot to unpack with that group. So I called first dibs for it.
I just wanted to add as a quick sidebar. Yeah, last December, I reached out to the Heaven's Gate, because you can still go to their website and everything, and I paid the $5 shipping, and they'll send you VHS videotapes that they had from, like, 1996.
Wow, that's really something.
Yeah, I think Heaven's Gate is fascinating.
Yeah, I would agree.
Especially because, I mean, especially the kind of breadth of cults that you cover in this graphic novel, T and Doe are some of the most interesting ones, because like they don't seem to be either vindictive or narcissistic in the way that most kind of cult leaders run it or make their way into it, like Jim Jones or even Manson for an extent. Like, there doesn't seem to be kind of the lust or the need for power. Like they kind of, like, good faith make their way into it, it seems. And it's just really interesting because the followers seem to follow the same path of many cults, and it's just kind of how they get there with T&O is interesting. Because, I mean, like, was it Umshirikyo, very much along the nerdy path, but that, like, that guy was very much about, you know, power and taking over and getting the most out of the members, where, like, T&O didn't seem to be really, like, reaping the benefits of the members in any way.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't let them off the hook completely. I mean, you know, the members did give up all their wealth to join this group. And I'm sure that, like, you know, I believe that T&O, like, they believed their own, what they're preaching. They did think that they were, you know, incarnations of these alien beings, like Jesus who came before them. Like I think they actually believed that. I don't think they were trying to, you know, bilk their followers or anything. But still, I feel like they were probably feeding off that the power that you feel when someone treats you like a literal god. Like it's that goes to your head. So it's you know, I can't really get inside their brain and what they were thinking and really make a judgment on whether they were, you know, good cult leaders or bad ones. Right. I think there was some manipulation there for sure. That and you know, yeah, they took advantage of their followers, maybe in good faith on their part, thinking they were, you know, heavenly beings, but the results were still pretty devastating for a lot of people.
For kind of your story and kind of overseeing the other stories as an editor and kind of like curator of these, and something you talked about prior to the project when you did the Kickstarter and even kind of in your story and the kind of introduction is really exploring, again, not only the kind of, not ignoring the negatives, but really looking at, you know, the people who find themselves in these cults and kind of the empathy and being able to kind of understand that human story. And those are like kind of often the like true crime journalism, like that I'm really interested. There's a podcast, you know, True Crime Bullshit, which is about like Israel Keyes. And while like, you know, this, he's a monster, it is kind of exploring the thought process and the, you know, the victims and everything like that, and really kind of looking at it from a larger perspective and where, you know, how people get to these things. Was that something that was very important? Was that kind of like a mandate across the board, like really kind of delving into the side of how people get into these cults and kind of what having some sort of like at least empathetic view of the members themselves who are often taken advantage of?
Yeah, that was essential from the beginning. And when I approached creators that I was inviting to be in the book, I did tell them that that's the kind of approach we want with this book. And I guess, you know, again, it kind of came from my love of true crime. Like, and it sounds like maybe you're a fan of true crime as well. And there's a lot of true crime podcasts out there, and some of them, their approach, it's not my thing. It's you know, it's like kind of like all blood and guts and scandal, and like, you know, it really sort of treats the real human beings in this story like they don't even exist. Like they're like, I, you know, these with true crime and with a lot of stories about cults, there's a lot of tragedy in there, and you know, you kind of owe it to the victims to tell their stories with honesty and empathy. I think with all journalism that's the case for sure. Mm-hmm. But I just think in true crime and in reporting about cults, it's often not done right, and I guess that's where I was coming from. Like, one of my favorite true crime podcasts is called Criminal. I just love their approach to talking about crime and like kind of telling the full story and having a really honest and empathetic approach to it. So I just wanted to do something a little similar with American Cult. I wanted this to be a book where, you know, it's about these people in these groups, and we're treating them as fully human. We're telling their whole story. So there's empathy here, but there's also, you know, justice here. Like we are holding people accountable when they commit wrongs. Like I feel like that's just what good journalism is. And I guess I wanted this to be, I mean, that was my point. Like I wanted to make a nonfiction graphic novel anthology that was a piece of comics journalism rather than just kind of something salacious and titillating and fun to read.
Yeah, I think that's a very hard thing to do, or well to do, in comics. And like I love nonfiction comics. I was thinking, like one of the what is it, the Green River Killer, is that what it's called? I don't remember the title of the book. It's with Jonathan Case, and the actual like writer is the son of the detective that worked on the case, and it's very much that kind of exploring the aspect of the victims, but also, you know, the toll it takes on an investigator stuff like that. It's very hard to do, I think, a lot of times too, because of the stylized nature of comics as well. Is that something, the kind of range of styles and approaches to the art in this, again, kind of, I would say more on, like, stripped down, is that something, again, being aware of kind of the content and the nature of the stories that the creators are covering, was there kind of a thought into what the art would be like in the way of either coloring it or stylizing it or anything like that, especially as someone who was putting their own art in the book?
I guess, you know, I really just picked creators who I was a fan of their art style, and I thought it would be appropriate for the subject matter. And it seems like all the creators had a good sense of what kind of art style would be appropriate for this book. They didn't turn anything that was kind of goofy and wacky and, like, you know, just they understood the gravity of these stories. So, like, it seemed like the creators all got it. So I didn't need to coach them on that regard.
Was there anything, I mean, again, in your kind of larger career doing a lot of editing, publishing, and even journalism and curating of comics, taking on a big project like this, is there anything you took away as an editor and also kind of as a creator looking at all the other projects? Is there a different thing you take away as someone who's kind of looking over all the other projects as an actual creator in the book? Is there, like, a larger thing you take away when you kind of get it all together?
I mean, I certainly did learn a lot from doing this project. And some of the things I learned were really practical. Like, I'm a lot better at InDesign, because I did lay this book out in InDesign. And before, I just used InDesign for really simple mini comic projects. And, like, another practical thing is, like, if I was ever to do an anthology like this again, I would have really solid, like, art guidelines with, like, templates with margins that have, you know, like, like, maybe that sounds a little obvious, like, yeah, I should have had that day one, but yeah, it's not just enough to tell someone the page size is 6x9, you need to let them know what the margins are, and like, what DPI, and I wish I just created a document that just had all that information laid out perfectly. I kind of did it, like, patchwork, like, as creator to creator, like, just email them the information. But yeah, like, I guess, you know, yeah, I did really, until Avi joined me, I did everything on my own. So I, like, drafted the contracts myself, I, you know, laid out the books myself, I gave all the editorial feedback myself. I learned a lot having to do every step by myself instead of working with a team of people, which is what I'm used to doing at First Second.
You've mentioned kind of the mini comics and the self-publishing on that end, and I know you do the Tiny Report. And I think for a lot of people, especially kind of in fans of indie comics, like, mini comics are, like, I think, like, the quintessential, like, indie comic, or kind of, like, you know, the thing I think of or I love most. Like, what is it, as someone who kind of participates in that, but also kind of curates it and explores it and really kind of examines it, like, what is the appeal, I guess, of the mini comic, or where do you find that, like, falls in the history of comics?
I mean, I love mini comics. I mean, if you want to talk about mini comics, I'm the mini comics person. They are kind of my big thing. I guess one reason I really love mini comics is it's how I entered comics. Like, in the 90s, I was a teenager and I made zines, and then I went to art school and I would go to comic conventions and eventually table there. Like, I tabled at SPX for the first time, I think, in 99 or somewhere around there. And yeah, so it was really my community. So I've always just loved small press comics, and I have a very big collection of them. I have about 2,000 of them, of 2,000 mini comics in short boxes behind me right now. So yeah, I think it's a really neat art form, because anybody can make them. Like, really all you need is access to a photocopy machine, and you can publish. That's what I've always loved about it. So, you know, even as a teenager, I could publish a zine. That's great. Like, it's not like if you wanted to make a film and you'd need all this fancy equipment and all this money and all these actors. With a mini comic, you could just really do it all yourself and like make a few copies with, you know, a couple of dollars, you know? So, yeah. And I think there's a really great history, to mini comics. So yeah, I just love them. It's hard to explain exactly why, but, yeah, they're great.
Yeah. Or you can wait until everyone at your office leaves and you can use the office printer.
Like, yeah. There's a long history of that in the world of mini comics for sure. Like, yeah.
Yeah. That's the first, I did one once out of, I was going to New York Comic Con to cover it for press stuff. And the one year I was like, I'll put a deadline on myself to do one. So, I made one and only, and I did all the work, but it took me forever to figure out how, like you were kind of talking about, but obviously, far more advanced than your end, like printing on both sides and like what side I got to turn over and what it took me fucking forever. I was like at work and they're like, why are you these late hours, Kyle? I was like, I don't know reason. I'm just working real hard over here.
Yeah. Once you've done it a couple of times, you got it down. I've been making mini comics really just forever for like over 20 years. So it's like, it's, I've got it all down. Now it's easy.
And it is, like you said, it is really, having kids, and that's really something like I've tried to impart in them is like, it is like a really, is the medium you can really, I don't want to say like it's easy to do, but like you can, you know, expect like art is expressive and then comics is a storytelling medium. So you can combine the two and really, you know, do anything you want in that sense. And, you know, there's ways to do it and make it and do it. And that's like really something we've, you know, tried to do with the kids. Like they read the comics. So I bought them like these like real, like at Barnes & Noble, you can get like empty comic books and like just fill them up with stuff. And like comics is such a like a fun medium to where like, again, it combines a bit of everything, whether it's film, you know, prose, photography. Like you can do all of that within comics and kind of really tell this narrative. And, you know, anyone can do it. It's obviously subjective, but like it's really a limit only on yourself. For you as also an editor and doing Silver Sprocket and then First Second, which is another amazing publisher, coming out of the creator side as well, doing art, like what is, for people who don't know, and I think it's a part of the comics field that I think most, even, you know, readers have no idea of, like what is the kind of overarching or like broad scope of what an editor does, especially for kind of comics or graphic novels?
I think it probably matters at what publishing house they work, because I feel like different houses have different approaches. Like where I work at First Second, we're really involved editors, really from the development stage through the production stage. So we would be giving, you know, notes on character designs and thumbnails and scripts and pencils and inks, and on through the copy edit stage, where I think some publishers, they treat the editorial job almost more as a curator job. Like the book comes to them more or less complete, and they'll probably copy edit it and maybe, you know, point out some, hey, there's a few problems here and there, but they're more like a curator at a museum hanging the work on the wall rather than someone who's like giving a lot of feedback and notes on, you know, I'm kind of confused about this chapter, or what if we, you know, move this page here, or that sort of stuff. So, but at where I work, you know, yeah, we're just very involved in like shaping the story to make it the best it can be from the beginning to end. But there's a lot of other work beyond that. a lot of the work is just doing your best to keep the book on schedule, get it to the copy editor, get it to the printer, get it published on time, and do it again for the next one. It's a lot of juggling. You know, at First Second, we put out about 45 books a year. So yeah, so we'll be working on books for a couple seasons and years out into the future. So it's a lot of juggling. It's a lot of time management. It's a lot of author care. It's a lot of emails, to be honest. That's probably most jobs are like mostly email these days. But like, yeah, it feels like a big part of my day is like just answering emails, like checking in with this author to see how they're doing on the book and when they might be turning in pages. And then, you know, checking in with this person to see like, okay, so when are we going to get this book back from the copy editor? And, you know, checking in with this person to see, hey, has the publicist reached out to the author? Do we have a plan for, you know, a book launch? Yeah, there's just so many moving parts, and it's mostly just, you know, trying to keep in touch with everybody, keep everything on schedule, and hopefully the books publish on time.
Is that, again, kind of that very unique skill set, does that transfer over, like, spending so much time kind of in that mode, in that eye, when it comes to kind of your own creating and stuff like that? Is it easy to, I wouldn't say turn it off, but like, is there a lot that carries over from kind of skill set to skill set, especially kind of in your, I think, more unique approach to comics, like something like, you know, Twin Bed, even like that was kind of told differently. Is there a unique skill set that you're able to kind of use from the editing world to bring over into like your own creative side in creating your own comics?
I think it maybe is the other way around, where like my experience as a creator might like carry over more into editing. Mm-hmm. In the sense that I feel like I have a pretty good brain for comics. Like it's really all I've been thinking about for the last 20 years, and I like have 2 degrees in it, and like so I just spend a lot of time thinking about like what makes a good comic a good comic, and I don't know. I think I have a pretty good brain for it. So that started for me being a creator who went to art school. So I think that helps me as an editor. And I think also just since I did come from the art side of things, and I do create comics now and then. I'm a cartoonist. I do understand how hard comics are, how much labor is involved in making comics. Like even drawing a single page of comics, there's just hours and sometimes days of labor into that. And so I think when you come from that background with that understanding, as a comics editor, you don't, I mean, you just have a, you know what you're asking for when you ask your artist, hey, can you totally redraw this page? Like, you understand, like, that's not just something you can ask for, like, it's nothing. That's going to be, you know, days out of the author's life when they could be doing something else. They could be working their day job. They could be earning a living. Like, so I feel like that's sort of a rookie mistake that a lot of editors make when they're editing a graphic novel for the first time, is that they just don't understand how much labor goes into drawing a page of comics. And I think I get that. So I think I respect that.
I always think of that story from when like Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberger came in and like were like, oh, we can just like, you know, edit this and redo it and make some, and they're like, no, you know, it's not how animated movies work at Disney. Like, we can't just redraw this quickly. And they're like, oh, okay, I didn't know that's how things were made. I'm like, oh yeah, it's really fucking difficult to make.
Yeah, because like rewriting some text is pretty easy, like comparatively, but redrawing a page, no, it's so much harder.
No, it shouldn't take that. I had 2 questions for you, Tim's final question. One, what is, just for anyone not aware, I think one of the coolest things you do is the one of the librarians at the Schultz Library and the Center for Cartoon Studies. Like, what, if anyone's not aware of that, or like kind of what you know, that program is, like, what is that, and like, what's your kind of involvement in that?
Well, I was involved with CCS when they first got started in 2005, and I worked there for the first 5 years, so it's been a long time since I've worked there. But when I was there, I did work in their library, which is the Schultz Library. It's still there. It's bigger and better than ever. And yeah, it's, you know, it's basically a comic library for the students. A lot of graphic novels, a lot of mini comics. It's a great collection. But yeah, like in CCS, if you're not familiar with it, it's like a 2-year cartooning program, an independent program in White River Junction, Vermont. Yeah, check it out.
And then for anyone that's is interested in picking up American culture or does, and what do you hope they kind of take away from their experience in reading it, either both kind of on the comic end, but also kind of on the, again, the content you're kind of covering with that book?
I mean, I will hope that they've learned a lot of things that they didn't know before. I mean, there's just so many religious cults in America's history that, and I feel like I've paid a lot of attention to that history and read about them a lot, but there's just so many stories that I don't know. There's so many groups that I don't know about. So there's a really rich history out there. So I'm sure like that any reader who comes to this book, even if they're really kind of familiar with some of this material, they're going to learn something new, which I would hope that they would. And I hope that they would come away with the perspective of what the people in these groups might have experienced and what their, you know, why they made the choices they did. And just really understanding that, you know, most of the people in these groups, they weren't stupid, they weren't brainwashed, they, you know, made choices to, for those of the, that did make choices to join these groups, sometimes you're born into a group and that's sort of a different experience. But for people who chose to be members of these groups, they were often like, you know, following the spiritual path that was really important to them and often was, you know, led by some really, you know, good values. Like they wanted to live a better life, follow a higher path, you know. And I think that's, you know, something to respect. Like they gave up a lot to follow this path, to live this life that they thought was, you know, a higher path. And unfortunately, in the stories in this book, usually that it didn't work out too well for them, and they were taken advantage of, and they were manipulated. But they, you know, they weren't brainwashed fools. They were ambitious, often like smart, talented individuals who were following this spiritual path and were taken advantage of by someone. And honestly, it could happen to a lot of us if we were in that circumstance.
Yeah, I think, again, it's such an interesting topic, again, especially kind of often it's you know, the lens is focused on the people at the top. And again, kind of the people who make the people at the top the kind of parts of history that we focus on. Again, like you said, these are generally, they want, like often the cults are kind of built upon smart, successful people because that kind of what builds a cult up. And again, you know, at that point, if you've, you know, given up all your belongings and all that, not only like, again, you're isolated, but like no one wants to feel stupid or that they were wrong. So like to kind of admit that, you know, I gave up my house and my money is to admit that you were like, you know, wrong. And like, you know, that's a huge like kind of flaw and something that people don't want to do. And like that's, it's so easy to see kind of how people slowly make their way down that path. And it's not like a wake up one day type of thing. I think that's what like, a lot of people think, like, oh, I would just leave. Like, oh, it's not that, you know, it's not that easy. And like to be able to kind of explore stories from that perspective is something that I think is really amazing about this anthology. Again, I think it's very smart and respectful, and also like kind of focusing on the larger picture or other ones, like the some of the like very early cults you guys cover is really great, to not just kind of like, it's not like a, like, you know, here's a Charles Manson piece. Like even that one is like exploring more the larger like ego driven necessity of Charles Manson and his failures and how that pushed other people. And like I think, again, I think what every creator involved in it does an amazing job of kind of exploring this this content very empathetically and interestingly.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that.
So, yeah, we're talking about smart and interesting. We'll go
to Tim's well, yep, final on that question. Note. All right. So, Robin, gun to your head, if you were forced to write one episode of Two and a Half Men, what would happen?
I haven't ever watched that show. So it's really hard for me to say. How about someone has a baby in a taxi? That's always good.
Oh, I don't know if they did that. I was looking. We do the dumb George Lopez intro because I hate the name of the show. And I was like, there's got to be an episode of George Lopez where they I feel like they always deal with, like, not cults, but, like, something along those lines in, like, sitcoms, but there was none. The closest was a George lying and being felt guilty by God or something, but it's the closest they tackled that on the show. Although I feel like there's a cult built around, or there could easily be a cult built around Charlie Sheen. I feel like it's not that far.
Oh, it probably was when he was in that.
But so if anyone is interested in the book, or again, the vast array of jobs and titles and work that you do, I don't know how you do all, how can they find out more about that?
Well, for the book, like, it's available at most retailers that you can find online, but the best place to order it would be Silver Sprocket's website. You can pre-order it now. And paperrocketcomics.com is my website. There's also American Cult. I think it's American Cult Comic. I hope that that is right. AmericanCultComic.com is my website for American Cult. But yeah, check out Silver Sprocket. That's kind of the number one place to find information about it.
Like I said, I can't express how much I enjoyed it, and I was very excited to see it go through. I mean, obviously, doing the editing work at Silver Sprocket as well, but like, I think Silver Sprocket is one of the most unique and smart publishers out there. I mean, the fact that, like, at one point, like, Avi went against Redbubble and has still continued that kind of campaign against that garbage is so interesting. Tim, where can people find you if they need to?
I write occasionally over at Comics Pit, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Tim Madura.
And again, we're a comic book podcast, so you didn't stumble upon it, that'd be weird, but we're at pages_panels. That's about it. But the most important thing is go out, pre-order. If you're listening to us and it's out, pick up American Cult. Like I said, it's absolutely fantastic. There's not enough nonfiction comics, so the more we can get and the more we can support the great ones, is worth it. So thank you so much, Robin, for taking the time talking to us.
Oh, thanks so much, Tim and Kyle.
And that is this episode, and I promise Tim, next time I'll schedule time to talk about George Lopez.
I can't wait.